Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And the U.S. Postal Service has finally delivered the June issue of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. And so we're going to get going on it this week. Sun and fun is the theme. What could be better than June? And it's especially good because this is the month my wife and I go on vacation down to Emerald Isle with our children and grandchildren. So I'm happy to see words like Atlantic Beach in here. We'll read about things that we're familiar with and enjoy. There's a little picture of a dog here sitting on a beach chair looking at us, and it does look like he has been in the surf. We're going to start out, as we always do, with the From Elizabeth column at the beginning of the magazine, Seaside Shangri-Las by Elizabeth Hudson, editor-in-chief. What a grand time it must have been at Kitty Hawk, at Kill Devil Hills, at Nag's Head back in the day, before there were flashy neon vacancy signs, before the four-lane bypass was built parallel to the beach road, before the motel billboard touted color television and free HBO. The Sea Ranch, you know the one, ocean front on the Outer Banks, adorned with the curving azure seahorse on the side of the building, held weekly cocktail parties hosted by the owner, Alice Sykes. Story goes that Alice was instrumental in introducing liquor by the drink to Dare County, and likely sold the first mixed drink on the island. How I would love to know what that drink was. Guests were known to flock to the Sea Ranch for Alice's elaborately themed parties and her homemade crab bisque. What a glorious time it must have been to watch so many beach motels spring up 60 years ago, 70 years ago. The Tanarama Motel next to Avalon Pier, recognizable for the sky blue window shutters. The Beacon Motor Lodge, the Vacationer, the Viviana, the Sea Hotel, and Darolina Restaurant. All family-owned places with names that flirted with frivolity and gaiety, promising icy cold air conditioning and mom-and-pop warmth. I'm sorry these places didn't last, enduring only in memory now, victims of hurricanes or erosion or perhaps modern progress. But I can still get a sense of what a bright and breezy time it must have been for the 1960s-era Atlantis Lodge in Pine Knoll Shores, which has held on to its history so completely, its modernist architecture still intact, its live oak landscaping thriving through generations of care. It's a small thing, but I get a thrill when I'm handed the room key, an actual metal key, not a plastic card, dangling from its rhombus-shaped keychain, mid-century geometry in the palm of my hand, and open the door to the room with its retro furniture, its white tulip table, its polished sliding glass doors overlooking an ocean view that's immutable, unchanging, ageless. And I can still feel what it must have been like at the Blockade Runner in Wrightsville Beach, which propels me right into 1964 when that hotel was built. The lobby is modernized now with an undulating tiled ceiling and tropical murals and shiny metal fish sculptures on the wall. But the mood is still swanky. The structure, the bones, still intact. These legacy places on our coast, the classic First Colony Inn and the Seafoam Motel in Nag's Head, both on the National Register of Historic Places. The Cavalier by the Sea in Killdevil Hills, which still has its original knotty pine paneling on the walls of the rooms and clotheslines strung beneath the eaves to dry bathing suits, are retreats in every sense of the word. They are our vacation escapes, yes, but they also offer a retreat to another era, an ebb away. Long may they stand. And now, as I do each month at the first reading, after we talk to Elizabeth, or hear Elizabeth talk to us, through me, I like to interpret the photo essay, for those of you who cannot see it or cannot see it clearly, to try to get a real enjoyment from the photographs that the photographers have found from around our state. This month it's called Design in the Dunes, Not Your Average Beach House, from the clean lines of a flat-top cottage in Southern Shores to the extravagant opulence of an Art Nouveau icon in Corolla. Landmark architecture defines our coastal villages and chapters of our history. You'll be listening to the words of Marimar McNaughton while I'll be enjoying the photography of Emily Chaplin and Chris Council. Double page spread as always under the title. No TV, no kidding. Here only breakers roar or the occasional thrum of offshore trawlers. Since 1969, the Mackey family has preserved this authentic 1955 flat-top cottage, a Southern Shores historic landmark. Well, let me first describe the sky. It's one of those gorgeous Carolina skies, beautiful Carolina blue, wispy, slightly puffy and spread out clouds up there, nothing to get in the way of your enjoyment of the day. Right down the middle of the page, coming from top to bottom, we see a line. It is the horizon, where light blue meets darker blue, perhaps enhanced a little bit in the printing of the color of the ocean, I'm not sure, but a gorgeous blue-green ocean. And then, what do we see? The white flat-top roof. Boy, they're hard to find. It really is 50s architecture. I suppose there's a tiny amount of slope to get the water to come off from the center, but you can't tell it. It looks completely flat. The only thing that's interrupting the roof is two of those pipes that come up from the bathrooms where it's allow the water to flush down the toilet properly by giving a little air intake at the top. And then there is a brick chimney on the front of the house. We see the driveway coming in, and it turns a sharp left here and goes into a garage, which isn't all that common. This is not built up at all. It's not on stilts. It seems to be up on quite a high dune, so they probably don't have a water influx problem. The windows on this completely white cottage have these large shutters on them, not the ones that go from side to side, but the ones that go from top to bottom. They're all propped open somehow. I can't tell how they're propped open, but whether it's a single or a double, they're propped out at just about 15 degrees off of the horizontal. The trim of the cottage is a blue, a medium blue, and the chairs outside, the Adirondack chairs, are also a medium blue. There's a piece of driftwood attached to the front of the it's a large fireplace outside, you know, that sort of a cover outside. And they have taken a large piece of driftwood, and it's almost in the shape of a bird. It looks like it has a a little beak at one end. I don't really know why they did it. And on the right end, there is a completely screened-in porch. And then you see a walkway that goes somewhere out of our sight down to the beach. So that's a long explanation of their little cottage here, which does also have a little legitimate grass and some somewhat scraggly shrubs out in front of the house. Overleaf, more flat top. These on southern shores. Think of these houses as dunescapes, recreated in lines and blocks. Open wood soffits show structural elements from inside out. Little lumber was used to build the outer shells, which were made from sand and sediment. These designs, borrowed from prairie and Bauhaus styles, were cemented into a rustic mid-century vernacular by maverick builder and real estate visionary Frank Stick. A talented artist and commercial illustrator, the National Parks conservationist christened Southern Shores and built his first block cottages on the oceanfront in 1947. Some folks thought he was plumb crazy, but not Peter Dunn, whose family owned and relished one of the Ocean Boulevard originals. Arriving, driving up, opening the door, you get that wonderful cedar smell, Dunn recalls. You open the back door, you get the ocean smell, and you're home. Well, we don't see the roof on this one, but we can tell it's flat, and it's not white outside. It is pink as pink can be. Reminds me of peppermint stick ice cream. But it also has those vertical shutters, the ones that have come out at the top of the window and hang down. But they're all hitched up over the overhanging roof. They have a nice lawn and a nice paved front walkway up to the screen door in the front. Beautiful Carolina sky in the background. Let's go inside. Pink Perfection, so named for a favorite camellia and painted in shades of its likeness, this summer home was loved and preserved by the Pipkin family for generations. It's crammed with mementos, a vintage life preserver, a classic M. Charles seascape, and the original house plans signed by renowned North Carolina modernist architect Edward Lowenstein. Authentic juniper paneling and cabinetry was harvested from Lower Currituck County by the team of Spruill and Perry. Being at the house deepens the experience. At daybreak, expect to find deer tracks in the dunes and see gull prints where the surf licks the shore. By afternoon, balmy summer winds flow through the bedroom wing, breezing through clerestory windows and into the living spaces on their way through the screened porch and seaweed. We've got an inside shot here. The beautiful paneled walls, lots of knot holes in them, give I don't know that the holes are there, but the knots are there, give it a lot of character, and also a wooden roof up above. We see a wooden dining room table with wooden chairs around it. I must say that looks like a linoleum floor in the kitchen. We just see a little bit of the kitchen. About 13 Skyline Road. Skyline Road rests at the site of this vintage flat-top cottage. From here, it's entirely possible to peel back layers of old-growth native shrubs and trees. And, yes, newer two-story summer homes to imagine the far view from the triple-panel window when this Frank Stick-designed cottage was built in 1953. The last owner donated the house to the Outer Banks Community Foundation in 2007. The OBCF created the Flat Top Preservation Fund with interest accrued, earmarked for maintenance and repairs in perpetuity. This is a real small one. It's off-white on the front. Looks like there's one room on the left and one room on the right, and they do have a garage, and there's a lot of forestry around it, too. And here are Frank and David Stick, and one of them is smoking a pipe. That's something you don't see very often anymore. A chip off the old block, David Stick, the one smoking the pipe, followed in the footsteps of his father, Frank. He also designed some classic flat-top cottages when he and Dad weren't penning and inking Graveyard of the Atlantic and An Artist's Catch. Overleaf now, shutters like awnings provide shade in summer, plus a palette for self-expression, peach for the Gudis family's cottage on Wax Myrtle Trail, and a creamy asparagus medley at the Millis's flat top on Ocean Boulevard. And here again is that shutter that comes down from the top. These are propped up, however. You can see a stick that's holding these up, and you see the peach color on them. Rearview mirror. Had the value of Southern Shore's idiomatic flat-top cottages been recognized decades ago, a national historic district like the one preserving Nag's Head Beach Cottage Row may have succeeded. Nevertheless, one by one, some have been spared demolition. The town of Southern Shores launched a historic landmark commission in 2016. So far, six flat tops have been plaqued. That won't stop nor'easters from barreling up the Gulf Stream or hurricanes from churning the waters, but at 42 pounds per concrete block, the last flat tops won't be going anywhere anytime soon. This is a looks like a newly repainted. It is white on the front. It's got a striped awning over the two windows. Well, it's not an awning. It's one of those, it's a shutter awning, if you will. It happens to be painted green and white, or the boards are painted green and white, but you can see they're propped up. Big piece of driftwood in the front yard and some nice landscaping around the house and some trees off to the right in the back. The unpainted aristocracy of Nag's Head. Jonathan Daniels was the first to write the phrase unpainted aristocracy, and Catherine Bishier, our state's foremost authority on historic architecture, was the first to borrow it. Bishier herself was socially acquainted with Daniels when he was editor of the Raleigh News and Observer. He coined the phrase to describe the old Nag's Head oceanfront village. She minted it, and it stuck. This chunky American four-square style, shown here, is gathered beneath a hipped roof. Looking north from the Strand, the skyline is defined by gable-roofed summer homes, some with dormered bunk rooms. Oh, the stories they could tell. Here we see all of this natural shingle building here. And it again has this type of shutter that I don't see very often, which is propped up with a piece of wood underneath, has a big covered deck running around the first level and stairs coming down to the open beach and a couple of Adirondacks out on the beach, hopefully far enough away from high tide. The house next to them has a much darker shutter on it, and you see those dormered rooms that they were talking about. Some nice beach grass on a small dune in the front of us, and lots of footprints in the sand. Overleaf, the pilings and see-through planks of the unpainted aristocracy give and take in the wake of tidal surges, and wooden shingles, not shakes, are easily replaced when storms blow. Deep, low-slung porches wrap around for shade, and bumped-out benches serve as built-in hammocks. So this is some close-ups of the porch. It's a covered porch with a rocking chair and screens that you can look out at all of the other houses down the beach. Here's a sign in the front of a store, local seafood, shrimp, crabs, oysters, and clams, and a white table outside, and a nice bowl full of very colorful conch shells that have been acquired over the years, no doubt. National treasures, Nag's Head Beach Cottage Row, a National Historic Registered District, celebrates old Nag's Head style as its own vernacular form. As early as the 1860s, planters and merchants built homes with salvaged wood or lumber from Elizabeth City or other areas in the Albemarle. Like others conducting architectural surveys in the 1970s, Bishier interviewed many elderly people. I remember this one couple. When they talked about Nag's Head, they laughed and smiled and looked 10 or 15 years younger, Bishier says. I have fond memories of being there. I think it's a super special place. A view of a cottage up on stilts. You've got a, I'm going to call it a wheelchair ramp. It's a ramp coming up at the proper angle, it would seem, at the side to a covered porch. And there's a hammock that's right out on the end. And the shingles on the side of the building. How about the coastal landmarks of Currituck County? First-timers may wonder if the journey will ever end. As North Carolina Highway 12 crawls north toward Corolla, consider this. Native Americans left footprints in these sands and named the area Carotank, later pronounced Currituck, meaning land of the wild goose. for Knight Rider's The Currituck Beach Lighthouse, completed in 1875, beams brightly from dusk until dawn. That sweeping beacon also illuminates Corolla Island, the name given to the most opulent of all of Currituck's famed hunting clubs, today known as the Whalehead Club. So we see that lighthouse here, and it's reflected in the pond because this is a night picture. There are lights in the park. The park looks very nice and clean and inviting. There's a picnic table out by the water. Then there's a big yellowish building here to the right. It has five chimneys that I can see. Dormer windows all along the second level. And a porch that's sunk in between two outer sections, which stick out a little bit. And another porch on the end with a balconied porch on this end also. And a wonderful reflection in the water. There's a slight ripple in the water, so the image is upside down and ripply. The Whalehead Club. When the Whalehead Club curator Jill Landon opens the door of the 43-room mansion, she sometimes catches a spectral whiff of a cigar and smiles. Landon is motivated by the mystique surrounding Edward Collings Knight Jr. and his bride, Marie-Louise LaBelle, the couple who built the 21,000-square-foot home now owned by Currituck County. Yes, they were rich. Yet so were the members of most Currituck hunk clubs. But Mrs. Knight was not your average lady. She was French-Canadian and enjoyed shooting. So the Knights built a hunting mansion of their own, now considered to be one of the finest expressions of Art Nouveau life in the county. They likely purchased the entire rooms in vogue during the 1904 St. Louis Exposition, inspired by fluid forms found in nature. Construction began in 1922 and ended in 1925. A letter written by the couple's contractor states, "This is going to be a puzzle, but Madame knows what she wants." Painted corduroy walls frame the entrance of the Knight's water-lily-themed dining room. Hand-carved wall panels echo Tiffany sconce globes, numbered and signed. Duckbills are forged into the window hinges and handles. Large sound-facing windows light the cheery pink kitchen. It's a real happy place, Landon says. So we're looking into the dining room here from whatever room abuts it. It's not just a doorway. It is a very unusual and interesting wooden frame. It's beautifully carved, and it's a rich cherry-like wood. Does it say it's something else, or am I okay saying it's... It doesn't say what it is. So, yes, it's cherry wood. It's beautiful. It isn't straight. It bows out at the bottom and comes to a foot. It bows out at the top. Somebody did magnificent work here. Then there's a couple of panels that drop down. You walk in, and it's a sliding door. And boy, the builders hate those things, because if they ever come off the tracks, it's a nightmare to get it back on. But it looks like it might be a double sliding glass door, wooden door from either side, and there's some kind of switches that are built into the entranceway. So it's a thick entranceway, too. We see a sort of a pewter blue, maybe a turquoise, I'm not sure, dining room table with six chairs, and everything is set with wine glasses of a type that is not common today, and looks like perhaps a soup bowl set on a plate in the distance, and looks like a fireplace, perhaps, not quite sure. It's kind of, I won't say out of focus, but you can't tell whether it's a framed picture that's really down low or a fireplace. But above it, there is a picture of a man from many years back, because we don't dress like that anymore, and a couple of sconces on either side. And then the kitchen picture shows a working table in the middle, and it's got a place for cupcakes and a rolling pin and a pan with some sort of an implement in it, an open cookbook, a big bowl with an implement in that, some flour perhaps, and some other bowls. And it's got one of those things, and I don't know the name of it, I'm sorry, that hangs down from the ceiling and has locks of hooks. So you hang up your pans and your graters and your beaters and all of those things that you wouldn't find typically in a home, but you'd find in a working kitchen. And there's a big old I'm going to call it a refrigerator. I don't know whether it's a large stand-up ice chest or it actually was an electric refrigerator in the back. The doors are wide open, but it's just to show us the inside, but it's very old, that's for sure. And then we have the Lighthouse Keepers. After the last Currituck Inlet closed in 1828 and Civil War soldiers discovered Currituck Sound teeming with waterfowl, word spread. Currituck Duck appeared on menus in the finest hotel restaurants. Private hunt clubs popped up, and yet the dark stretch of coastline still posed a challenge for mariners. Megan Agresto, site manager of the Currituck Beach Light Station, says the Currituck Beach was a peninsula when the wicks were lit in December 1875. 6 months later, the keeper's duplex house was completed on site. Originally framed in Baltimore, it was disassembled for transport and reconstructed by a crew of about 20 men, including German house carpenter William Horner, who signed the attic eave. Now finishing up this job, May 8, 1876. According to Agresto, whose family lived in the house for a spell, Victorian stick style ages very well. And then there's an aerial view of a house down here in the lower right-hand corner. Overleaf, Captain Charles's station on Bald Head Island, where the Cape Fear River empties into the Atlantic, there's an island. Men have bought and sold it, changing its name from Smith Island to Palmetto Island. Yet to seafarers, the dune on the west end of the Cape has long been Bald Island. The rising dune was a prominent headland, says maritime historian and award-winning author Kevin Duffus. Margaret Swan Hood, who was the daughter of Captain Charles Norton Swan, keeper of the Cape Fear Lighthouse from 1903 to 1933, recalled in an interview, "You'd go out and look way out there, and you couldn't see a thing. And if you looked long and hard enough, you might see three little sticks, and then if you waited, you might see a ship come over the horizon." Where he stands, or rather when he stands on the station house porch now, Duffus muses, "I certainly would have loved to have been one of Captain Charlie's children," he says. "Sounds like an idyllic time." Boy, this is a beautiful picture. It's taken probably from a drone out over the very green water that's coming up here on the beach. Somebody's walking along the beach, and then you've got very steep dunes, where they drop off. These aren't your ones you walk up. It's where they drop off, and continually you have to worry about the erosion. And there's four houses up there. They're all very similar style, and they're just waiting for their time in the future when nature says, "Time's up," because that dune is too close to the edge of your property. But they have a few years to go. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can reach at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.